All right.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session with Judges Larkin, Tracy Smith, and Flory, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
Great. Good morning and welcome everyone to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's June 16, 2021. We have two oral matters on our calendar today. The first one, which we're ready for, is in the matter of the Otto Bremer Trust, court file 821-0053. As you know, even though we're appearing by Zoom today, all the rules apply as if we were together in the courtroom, which means you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. We will be recording the proceedings here today, and those will be made available pursuant to our rules, and it would be helpful for us if you would identify yourselves for our record as you begin your arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. Carol Washington on behalf of the state of Minnesota by its Attorney General, Keith Ellison. May it please the court, this is an appeal from an equitable action about what's best for Otto Bremer Trust and the public that benefits from it. What this means is that the Attorney General stands in the shoes of the public as beneficiaries. It means trustees have an inveterate duty to protect the trust and give the beneficiaries their undivided loyalty. They are fiduciaries. And it means that the probate court here, as has been the case from, quote, the earliest period of jurisprudence, and that's from the Wharton case, the court has an affirmative, independent duty to supervise and protect the trust. Centuries of common law, codified in statute, give the probate court simple, direct, and intuitive paths to use its broad equitable discretion to protect the trust. But what I'd like to talk about today is how the probate court strayed from that direct path and by extension from its primary directive. First, the court failed to apply the clear, simple standard in 0706C. Pending a final removal decision, determine what's necessary to protect the trust and then order that relief.
So Ms. Washington, how did that not happen? I mean, they ordered a majority of the relief you requested in terms of protecting the assets of the trust. What they didn't do is temporarily replace the trustees, among a couple of other things. So how did the court abuse its discretion in granting the relief it did or didn't grant? And how did that affect the protection of the assets of the trust?
The court applied the wrong legal standard in determining what remedies were available to it on the Attorney General's petition. So it prejudiced the Attorney General because the court put an obstacle course with several different paths to follow, which is Dahlberg. Dahlberg is an obstacle course. And the court put that in front of it before it determined that the Attorney General could be awarded the interim relief that it requested. Now, to be clear, that interim relief was not just removal. In fact, removal was an alternative request for relief. We sought suspension and the appointment of a special fiduciary. All of these remedies are separate from removal, but the court's order lumped them all in together under the removal standard. Why does that
matter? Counsel, did it really lump them together when the court at the bottom of 11 of the order said the code and the act provide the carryover sentence, ample basis for the court to order interim relief deemed necessary to protect the interests of the trust. And then it goes on to say, however, then it would be proper to include it would be improper to prematurely include that without due process that the removing the trustees would be appropriate. And then it goes on to, and then it imports two of the Dahlberg, or it relies on two, you know, basically says three of the Dahlberg factors, you know, don't answer it. Let's look at two, whether there's a likelihood of success on the merits and whether there would be harm. So I guess it seems like, I mean, the lumping together, what I'm wondering is whether you're lumping together the Dahlberg as impacting all of the injunctive relief that was ordered here, or the relief that was ordered, preliminary relief. I mean, the district court did order a lot of it. So why do you argue that it was, you know, laboring under a misapprehension of the law with respect to all of the relief that was requested?
Because the court told us what standard it was applying to its entire analysis. It referred to the interim remedy of removal, as quote unquote, an extraordinary remedy.
That's right, the removal, right?
But but so that's Dahlberg. But the court also told us what standards it was applying, because it did not actually apply any other substantive standard when ordering relief. And it did apply Dahlberg, and Dahlberg provides obstacles to awarding relief, all of the relief. So what the court did here was—
But may I just stop for a second? How did it create an obstacle for providing all of the relief if in fact the court ordered some of the relief? That's where I'm a little confused.
Because the court ordered limited relief, because the court, based upon its analysis, determined that there were these high hurdles to get certain types of relief, like removal. And I think another clue you have is if you look at paragraph 2 of the court's order. Paragraph 2 of the court's order says the request to remove trustees and appoint interim fiduciaries as special fiduciaries to take the possession of the trust property and administer the trust under 501c1001b5 is denied. 1001b5 is the special fiduciary provision. It's never mentioned once in its analysis. And why does this matter? Because this language lumps in together multiple remedies. It's special fiduciaries, which is completely separate. We could bring that on its own petition without any remedies. It lumps in presumably suspension, because it's not addressed at all, and removal. So it follows that it takes the heightened removal standard, which is itself is has issues, and applies it to all of the other remedies. By lumping in the remedies, the court lumped in together the legal standard that it applied.
So are you asking us to remand for the district court to reconsider under a different standard all of the injunctive relief? In other words, could it end up that there's zero? I mean, what about the stuff that was granted already?
Yes, we are asking for the court to remand in light of the appropriate standard. We are confident, based upon the evidence that we put in front of the court about what's happening with the court right now, which the court did not consider. Instead, focuses analysis on what the Attorney General might prove on a completely separate petition. But if the court looks at the evidence in front of it right now on the ongoing harm to the trust, which is its own merits, that it will have the power that the legislature intended to take immediate action and not wait for a trial on a completely different petition.
So what is the evidence of the ongoing harm that you're talking about?
So what we put in front of the court that's part of the record includes how the trustees are unable to separate their personal interests from their interests as fiduciaries in protecting the trust while litigation is ongoing. One really striking example is the attorney's fees that they're incurring without any limitation, a blank check both to protect themselves from us and in all of their multiple disputes with the bank. Based on their public filings from a week or so ago, they've exceeded $10 million in 2020 alone. That was before the trial started the proceedings continued in 2021. So we've showed how they've changed their policies to be more favorable to their litigation positions. They haven't taken steps that are necessary to protect their employees who fear retaliation, because they are concerned about whether or not they're going to lose the case. We've shown that their employees are fear retaliation from their actions right now, that feel pressure by the trustees. We've shown a pattern of conduct that show that these, our main argument that was never addressed, that these trustees cannot protect the trust and themselves at the same time. And this concept is well rooted in multiple cases that we put in front of the court. A great example is the Getty case, remarkably similar facts, explaining about how litigation conflicts are a malignancy on a trust and why temporary removal is appropriate, because it's not about punishing the trustees. It's not about proving they did anything wrong. It's about protecting the trust. On the Dahlberg issue, I'd like to briefly talk about the Nelson case because it's relatively recent and I know it's gonna come up. And as trustees have pointed out, this was an in rem case in probate court, and this court found it was error not to apply Dahlberg. But in Nelson, this distinction is clear. Certainly this court determined that the court's order was an injunction, but the statute itself wasn't an injunction. And it certainly gave the lower court no direction on what to do pending a final determination. So what did this court did is it filled that vacuum with Dahlberg. And here, subsection C, there's no vacuum. It gives the court complete and direct instructions on what to do pending a final determination. This same distinction applies to trustees' other cases like Dottie and Water Gremlin. So the rule can be reconciled like this, and this is the rule that's in Cross Country Bank. Where there is a vacuum for temporary equitable relief, the court fills it with Dahlberg. Where there's a statute for temporary equitable relief, the court applies the statute. Simple. And on the topic of Dahlberg.
Apropos of that, so the district court here gave some temporary relief and said it had ample basis to order that relief deemed necessary to protect the interest. If that relief that it did order is sufficient, we thought what's our role? Like, suppose if that relief was, or in fact is sufficient to protect the interests of the trust, what's the harm in even if the district court did apply Dahlberg? In other words, if the trust assets are sufficiently protected by the current interim relief, then is it just an academic question of whether the district court should have applied a different standard or not?
I don't think it's an academic question. If what you're getting at is what's the harm? Is this a harmless error if Dahlberg is applied? I think what we've established is Dahlberg changes the entire rubric. It changes the entire analysis. It puts the court's focus on the wrong things. It looks at the wrong arguments. It looks at the wrong facts. It looks at later. It looks at trustees. It looks what has yet to be proven. So it's not academic, because on remand, if the court is told you have authority to temporarily remove these trustees based upon the evidence that's in front of you now, you have authority to suspend these trustees, you have authority to appoint special fiduciaries, then the court being empowered to follow the plain language of the statute without determining that first any of the remedies are extraordinary, that is not harmless. That is not academic.
But this district court did recognize what I think you think the standard is at the start of its analysis, which is that 0.0706 allows for injunctive relief under 1.1001B, quote, as may be necessary to protect the trust or the interests of the beneficiaries. That's the standard that you think applies, right? The statutory standard. And if the district court ordered that relief as may be necessary to protect the trust property interests of the beneficiaries, but just didn't give everything you wanted, but it is in fact within its discretion, it was a reasonable determination that what it did was necessary to protect the interests of the beneficiaries of the trust property. Why wouldn't it be harmless error that you didn't get the removal or suspension if there's otherwise protection under the appropriate standard, which the court cited?
Because the court took the remedies off the table that we requested before we even got there. The court determined that it wanted a trial, an evidentiary hearing on our permanent removal petition. And so it determined that it would not be appropriate to order temporary removal and apparently suspension and apparently a special fiduciary before that trial. But if the court needed more information, the step that the court should have taken is order more proceedings on our interim petition. But the prejudice here is when the court ordered the relief, it applied the wrong standards in determining what relief was available to it. And it applied a standard that put an obstacle in front of the attorney general getting removal, appointment of a special fiduciary, or suspension in particular, it appears. I see my time is running out. So if this order is allowed to stand, it would create bad law, bad policies, and bad results, both for the case here and for future cases. It would make a clear, simple law uncertain and inconsistent. It would undermine the power and responsibility of the Attorney General and the probate court to protect beneficiaries. And it would make the probate court an instrumentality of the harm the Attorney General is actively litigating by allowing the trustees to drain charitable assets with impunity to fund their personal defenses.
Can I ask, I know you're winding up, but you do have a little bit left. On the question of attorney's fees, are you seeking, were you seeking or are you seeking that an order that would preclude them, the trustees from using trust assets to pay attorney's fees for this litigation as well as the two other, the employee lawsuit and the BFC's lawsuit against them?
Yes, there's, I think, more now. But yes, it's universal to all litigation without prior court approval pending the litigation. So we're not seeking permanent reversal of indemnifying the trustees permanently. What we're saying is they shouldn't be given a blank check to litigate all these disputes before the court does some kind of preliminary analysis first. That was the minimum that we requested is prior court approval.
And analysis of what with respect to the other litigation? I mean, some of your attorney's fees seem to focus on the enforcement litigation, especially the reference to the California case, which was just the AGO's litigation, right? And I think in your brief, you said, you know, at one point that they're spending millions on that. That seems unlikely, at least I hope at this point, millions spent on this lawsuit. I mean, you could tell me if I'm wrong, I don't know. But it wasn't clear to me what you're asking for with respect to, if I may go over, Lori, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
With respect to the other litigation and what you wanted to happen.
We lumped them all together. Okay. And because all of the reasons why it's inappropriate to give the trustees a blank check now are universal with respect to them instigating and worsening the litigation and being foreseeable and it being a harm that they should have mitigated. That applies to our case, that applies to all the other related BFC litigations. And like I said, we asked for a minimum that the court pre-approve it first. Now these fees are not a given because in every supervised trust case, at some point trustees will need to get approval of these fees anyway. What we simply asked is that it be moved up. And with that, I'll wait for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Ms. Washington. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. 50706C, excuse me, this is Michael V. Cerisi on behalf of Otto Bremer Trust. MSA 501C0706 is a discretionary statute. It is populated with discretionary words, such as may, if the court finds, if the court determines. The trial court, based on the entire record, not just unsubstantiated allegations made by the Attorney General, ordered interim relief with 8 targeted remedies to, quote, protect the interests of the trust, end of quote, quote, protect the assets of the trust, end of quote, and to, quote, compel full transparency of the trust administration. That's at pages 2, 11, 12, and 13 of the court's memorandum accompanying its order. The court also recognized that OBT was regulated by four governmental agencies, the Federal Reserve, the Attorney General, the court itself, and the IRS, that it filed annual reports, filed detailed petitions every 5 years, was and annually filed these audits, and that the Attorney General and the court had exercised significant oversight for decades over the trust. MSA 0706C allows but does not require a court to order interim relief under 1001B as may be necessary to protect the trust or interests of the beneficiaries pending a final decision to remove a trustee. Judge Awesome looked to that statutory framework, informed by the claims, the allegations, and the record, and exercised and properly exercised his discretion in ordering the targeted injunctive relief pending a trial on the merits in a little over 90 days from now on September 27th. The court's analysis acknowledged that in this action, the Attorney General's allegations are that the trustees constituted serious breaches of their fiduciary duties, which required removal. The court used the Dahlberg factors as a guide and framework in applying the statute to the factual allegations. The court determined that the Attorney General was unlikely to succeed on the merits, but that the statutory framework provided ample basis to order interim relief to address the court's concerns. And I would
direct- If I may, counsel, one of the arguments that I understand is that that the district court ordered some interim relief, as we know, and then went on to analyze the removal request under 0706B1.
Correct.
Okay. And one of the arguments by the Attorney General's office is that the district court ignored the other, I think only last two really would apply. I don't know that there was a lack of cooperation issue, but 3 and 4, that the court determines that removal best serves the interests of beneficiaries because of unwillingness to, et cetera, persistent failure to administer effectively, or the chain, or removal is requested by all of the qualified beneficiaries. I understand you have an argument about qualified beneficiary versus rights of, but explain to me why the district court did not make a legal error in analyzing only under B1 if the other grounds were raised.
It didn't make a legal error because it analyzed under all of them. It found no breach, Your Honor. It didn't
right,
find-
Right, but 3 and 4 don't require a breach.
No,
they
do
and
not.
B4, okay.
But what they require is that under 3, number one, that it best serves the interests of the beneficiaries, and the court ordered relief to best serve the interests of the beneficiaries. So that element is gone. And secondly, it says, or persistent failure of the trustee to administer the trust effectively, and the court ordered relief with respect to that in terms of enhancing the effectiveness of the administration of the trust. Under 4, the Attorney General did not adduce any evidence with respect to whether or not the requirement that the removal would be inconsistent with the material purpose of the trust, number one. But number two, again, the court found and ordered relief that best served the interests of the beneficiaries. So that requirement was already satisfied. So it did not have to apply that either B3 or 4 because—
So you're reading that into, I mean, would you agree that the district court did not anywhere explicitly evaluate 3 or 4?
I believe implicitly he evaluated 3 and 4 because he ordered relief that served the best interest of the trust. And so that requirement is no longer present. The court, you know, when you look at B, Your Honor, it says the court may remove a trustee if, and keep in mind that in the court below, all of the argument and discussion wasn't on B3 and 4. It was on serious breaches and removal. That was the entire argument. In fact, with respect to B4, there's only one sentence in their 107-page memorandum that refers to it. And all they say is that, well, the settler did not name these particular trustees, wholly ignoring the provision that specifically provided for appointment of trustees and successor trustees. And the evidence that will be robust with respect to that as to why that was in there. So there was no evidence on that down below. And the reason that a lot of the order deals with the serious breaches is because that's what was argued. And that was under B1. He ordered, when you go down to 706C, what it requires is that the court order relief, may order relief, not requires it to order, may order such relief that's appropriate under section 1001B as may be necessary to protect the trust property. That's precisely what he did. He went to 0706B and he went through each element and he provided relief that protected the trust property and the interests of the beneficiaries. And I would direct your honors to the court's order, which I think succinctly states it at pages 1 and 2 of its order, where it starts out with the fact that he's not making final findings. Again, there was not a finding of a breach found here, let alone a serious breach. So he didn't apply a different standard to the rest of the statute because he never found a breach. Nowhere in the order is there a breach. So at number one, he says he's not making final factual findings. He's made preliminary findings. He goes through that there's disputed facts. He goes through the history of the regulation and supervision of this trust by the four entities. He goes through his 2017 order, which encompasses many of the allegations that the Attorney General is making here, which was specifically approved by the court and acquiesced in by the Attorney General. And he says, after that, he goes on, with that in mind, the AGO's allegations can raise concerns about a number of areas of operations of the OBT. And by this order, the court orders interim relief. And what do those relief, where does that relief come from? It comes from B10110, which enables him to do whatever is appropriate in the exercise of his wide discretion in order to protect the interest of the trust or the interests of the beneficiaries, precisely what he did in this case.
Why is the argument wrong that I think what the Attorney General's office would say, but the district court believed itself, understood the law to be, misunderstood the law to be, that Dahlberg applied and that it couldn't remove the trustee, which is the, you know, number 7 under 1001B. It couldn't remove the trustee absent, you know, evaluation under Dahlberg that there was a serious breach of trust. And that limited itself in the analysis wrongly, and we should remand to have the district court apply a non-Dahlberg standard that's just simply the standard under C, whether it would be necessary to protect the trust property or interest.
Your Honor, 501C, 0706C may be met without removal under 1001B7, since the express language of the statute allows any appropriate relief under 1001B, as may be necessary to protect the trust property or the interests of the beneficiaries. And that is precisely what the court did. We need to go back when we're looking at this statute to 0706C. Pending a final decision on a petition to remove, or in lieu of, or in addition. In other words, a court could find that there was a serious breach and not remove in order relief under B1001B, because they're not even required to remove if there is a serious breach. It's left to the discretion of the court. And the reason for that is very simple. Removing a trustee for a past transgression is not what the statute's about. It's about protecting the trust on a going forward basis. And that is precisely what the court did by ordering 8 targeted injunctive reliefs, many of which, by the way, were suggested by the trustees themselves, so that their court would be satisfied that this trust was being administered. This trust has the lowest operating expense ratio. It's doubled its values over the last few years. It has granted more than $400 million. There's no, in the last 8 years, there's no claim of fraud here. There's no claim. In fact, they haven't shown any harm to the trust. Not one penny of harm to the trust.
Well, I think the harm to the trust that's being argued, though, or at least one, is that it's an abuse of discretion not to require more with respect to the extraordinary legal fees that are at issue with all of this litigation. Can you speak to the legal fees?
I find that interesting in a number of ways. Number one, I believe the Attorney General is aware that with respect to this litigation, there's D&O coverage. It's been submitted to the carrier. The carrier has accepted it and has accepted the fees that are the rates that are being charged. That's number one for this litigation. With respect to the third party litigation, that litigation has been stayed by the court. And moreover, in its papers, what the AG said was, you shouldn't have waited to be sued. You should have sued him. That's what they made. They made that argument in their reply brief in the court below that said, why would you sit back and wait to be sued? You should have went out and sued him. The court dealt with that at pages 6, 7, and 13 of his order with respect to attorney's fees. The trust itself expressly provides that fees can be paid, particularly if you're sued as a result of being in the position of being a trustee. That's what it says. The Getty case is inopposite in this situation. The Getty case was totally different. It involved third-party actions brought by individuals as a result of the sale of Getty Oil and the dispute that took place between Pennzoil in Texaco back in the, I believe it was the 80s or 90s, Your Honor. And I'm sure the courts are aware of that. And in that case, the court ruled that the trustee was removed only for the purposes of that litigation because he was the largest shareholder in Getty Oil and he was also sued. And the court looked at the conflicting issues that he was faced because the statutory creditor remedies would put him in a conflicting position because he would be aligned with the plaintiffs to show that his actions were within the purview of the authority of the trust, or if not within the purview of the authority of the trust, that it benefited the trust. And if he could show either one of those two, then the plaintiffs, third-party plaintiffs, could recover from the trust. And that is why the court said, in this situation, we're going to remove with respect to only that litigation. It did not remove Mr. Paul Getty from the balance of the trust responsibilities. I want to touch briefly on the Cross Country Bank, the Minnesota School of Business, and the Nelson Trilogy, because I think these are important. This statute has never been expressly before this court. It was in the Schwartz case in South Dakota, and the Schwartz case, I think, rightfully said, what this statute did is codified the common law.
Which statute are you referring to when you say this statute?
0706C.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. So in the Schwartz case in South Dakota, the court held that it codified the court's inherent equitable power, which this court exercised. But with regard to Cross Country Bank, that was for a temporary injunction. It was a statute that was enforcement statute that was mandatory. Minnesota Statute 8.31, Subdivision 3, which says the Attorney General shall be entitled to sue and have injunctive relief. In other words, if you prove the underlying prerequisites of the statute, you are entitled to get it. It's not within the discretion of the court. You have to order the injunction, but you have to meet that threshold. And that's the important aspect of that case.
Do we need to decide, counsel? Are you arguing that Dahlberg does apply in 0.0706 and that we need to decide that?
I don't believe you do need to decide that, Your Honor. What it is, but in Cross Country, the reason I mentioned that is because the court there did apply Dahlberg, where it didn't have to because it was the awesome case construct. But what the court said is the district court, this is a quote, the district court specifically found that the likelihood of the state's success on the merits weighed in favor of issuing the temporary injunction. We conclude that the district court's finding of likely success on the merits is supported by the record, is not clearly erroneous, and satisfies the requirement of a sufficient showing that the prerequisites for the statutory remedies have been demonstrated. That's what that case was about. And I might, it's important to point out that in that case, the appellant did not contest the application of Dahlberg. I want the court to be aware of that. But the court did apply the Dahlberg construct in order to evaluate. And that's what the court did here.
So, Mr. Sirisi, I'm going to ask that you wrap up here. You're over your time.
All right, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Then I would just, if I could have just 30 seconds to say two things. The court didn't find a breach of, that a breach was necessary under 0706. It required an, what it required was that you establish a threshold burden, which is necessary to protect the trust property or the interests of the beneficiaries. There's got to be a causal nexus as to whether the threshold showing for issuance of the remedy exists. That's what Dahlberg provided a context for the court to do, to look at those material evidentiary facts. And finally, with respect to fees, the fees are directly allowed under paragraphs 13 and 17, which is directly directly opposite to the cases cited in the Attorney General's brief. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Cerisi. Ms. Washington, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And you're muted. There you go.
I'd like to first address the court's question about not applying the non-breach grounds. For purposes of this petition, Section 501C requires removal only for a serious breach of trust. The court found that removal was available for a serious breach of trust under B1. That's what the court stated. And it did not look at whether or not removal would be available under the other factors. And this is important here because of how the court got to the serious breach of trust standard. It went to subsection C, which specifically authorizes the relief under 1001B. And it incorporated a requirement for a proof of a breach of trust just because 1001B also provides remedies for a breach of trust, even though that's not what the statute says. And applying the plain language is important, not applying a breach of trust, but remedies for a breach of trust. This is important because the Attorney General sought removal on non-breach grounds, but the probate court rule requires a threshold breach showing for interim removal, regardless of why removal is sought. Now, Mr. Cerisi pointed out some arguments trustees had that they think we were not entitled to our non-removal grounds, or we didn't prove them, or some other legal theory. But the court's rule and reading of the statute would apply regardless of the non-breach grounds are contested and regardless of the circumstances. If we sought to remove a trustee for incapacity, based upon the court's reasoning, we would have to show a threshold likelihood of success on breach because of its incorporation of 1001B.
I think the argument, as I understand it, is that what the AG pursued was removal based on a serious breach of trust, and the Attorney General did not really argue or forfeited, or only because by barely mentioning it, forfeited the other bases under sub 3 and sub 4, 0.07, 06B. Can you speak to that? We can talk academically, it would be a problem and an incapacity question, but we're not in an incapacity lawsuit. So we got to look at what was actually advanced in this lawsuit. And I think the argument is you didn't advance those other grounds.
Yeah, that argument is wrong. And we state in our reply all of the instances and pages of our reply brief on the interim petition in particular of all the arguments that we're making here on appeal. But also what's important is, you know, what we argued is what's necessary to protect the trust now under the plain language of the statute. We didn't argue about our permanent relief petition. And so it wasn't at the core focus in our initial brief to argue our later petition. That happened because the court took Dahlberg and looked at the merits of a separate petition. So that impacted what the Attorney General is focusing in and arguing. And if you look at the transcript, you look at our briefing for the relevant interim standard, we focus on what is happening with the trust right now. The arguments that the court lists as our interim arguments weren't the ones that we made. The arguments that that trustees list as our interim arguments weren't the ones that we made, because some of it has nothing to do with whether or not trustees have done anything wrong. It's completely irrelevant to the appointment of a special fiduciary because of conflicts or other issues, for example, whether or not trustees have done something wrong. We can bring a separate petition for that without any removal, without any breach. And in fact, we invoked those separate petition grounds, which were not discussed. So the point of this here is we argued about what is needed to protect the trust now, irrespective of any other final showing on a different petition for removing for other grounds. But even if Dahlberg applied and the merits of our final petition were necessary to be evaluated, the court, the way that the court did this was not the right way to do it.
I know I'm perhaps a broken record on this. Are you arguing that the relief that was ordered was not sufficient to protect the assets of the trust?
Yes.
Okay. And that was an abuse of discretion or a clear error of a finding of fact? What is that? What's our standard of review on that? Just briefly.
Yes. So the court the probate court's decision on whether or not Dahlberg applied or Dahlberg light or whatever is for it, there's no higher standard. But if you look at it like whether or not the court applied Dahlberg correctly or not, that's an abuse of discretion. But either way, you get to the same place. If the court's applying the wrong law, that's an abuse of discretion. But the determination of what the law is de novo.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Washington. Your rebuttal time has expired. And we appreciate the thorough briefing of both parties in this matter and your arguments here today. It's helpful to the court. The matter is submitted. We'll take it under advisement. We'll issue a decision in the statutory timeframe. We stand adjourned on this matter.
Thank you.